Hello, you're listening to the Art of Dying Well podcast with James Abbott and Steph McGillivray.
Hello, you are listening to the second Art of Dying Well podcast. This month we will be talking about palliative care, starting from what it is, who does it, who gets it, and why do we need palliative care in the first place? What is the point of palliative care? We, as always, are trying to bring home the message that talking about this sort of stuff is the best way to learn about it and to reintroduce it into our daily lives as something which is important and normal.
That's very true, Steph. Yes, hello. Our second podcast. I think this is quite exciting still, don't you? Still excited by this?
I am extremely excited by it.
Palliative care. It's interesting because I didn't really know what it was to begin with, until our friend of the Art of Dying Well project, Dr. Catherine Mannix, came into the studio and had a little word with us. So to give you the background on Catherine, she's a palliative care expert from the Northeast, proudly from the Northeast, with 30 years experience in her trade. So why don't we just let her do the talking, Steph? So here is Dr. Catherine Mannix telling us exactly what palliative care is.
Palliative care is a specialty discipline of medicine and nursing and other clinical sciences where the focus is on maximising somebody's quality of life, taking away whatever symptoms you can take away or making them as little bother to the patient as you can possibly do, and thinking about what can you do that makes a difference, that makes each day a better day than it would have been. So you're not trying to cure an illness. And that means that very often you're dealing with people whose illnesses are not going to be cured. But, for example, in the hospital team where I worked, sometimes we were working with people who were having treatment to cure them, but the side effects of the treatment or perhaps the symptoms of the illness itself were so severe that they wouldn't get through the treatment unless the palliative care team were helping to take the symptoms away. So it doesn't mean you're doomed if the palliative care team comes to see you, but it does mean that your symptoms are probably more severe than the usual services, expert though they are in different conditions, can deal with. And our expertise isn't a particular condition. It's the symptoms that lots of different conditions can cause.
Now you see, I'm sort of banging on about the fact my brother died young, but really, I thought the palliative care team was wonderful, absolutely wonderful. And 10 years on, I still think about them and the wonderful care. So we can look at this more positively, can't we?
Well, I like to think that people are pleased to see the palliative care team. It's a little bit difficult sometimes for doctors and nurses in other disciplines, general practitioners or surgeons in a hospital or whatever, sometimes to introduce the subject that actually things are perhaps not going so well and they want you to see the palliative care team, because people are fearful about what that might mean. And they fear that because you're seeing the palliative care team, that's some kind of shorthand for you've only got a little life left to live. I think seeing a palliative care team is something about making however long the life left to live be better, be more enjoyable, be more about the person you want to be and doing the things you want to do instead of having a bad pain or being breathless or whatever. So it means that we do end up looking after a lot of people who are at the end of their lives. And that means we get quite expert at managing the things that happen at the ends of people's lives as well. But we're not only an end-of-life service. We're very much about making life better, whatever your illness is, at the point you're at.
When we look at palliative care, and we look at dying in particular, you must have seen an awful lot, of course. How do people reconcile themselves to the fact that they are dying? It's something that quite often I'd imagine you see anxiety, fear, a bit of anger, no doubt. What exactly is dying like, and how do you communicate that?
Well, what an interesting and enormous question. Thank you for that. Steve Hewlett was talking to Eddie Mair on Radio 4, having just been told that he was not now well enough to have any further treatment to save his life and that his liver disease was too bad for him to have life-saving treatment. And Eddie Mair asked him what that was like, And what he said was actually what I see very often. He said, this is going to sound really odd, but it was just like when they told me I had cancer in the first place. I felt it was the next thing, the thing that I have to deal with. This is what's before me now, and I have to sort out how I deal with it. Or words to that effect. You can listen to him saying it very eloquently on the iPlayer. And that's a thing that I see very often, people not really being surprised because they've noticed that they're less well, or they've got new lumps in other places, or their breathing runs out halfway up the stairs instead of only at the top. You know, we're not silly. We're keeping an eye on ourselves all the time and noticing what's happening and noticing what's changing. So very often, it's more a matter of confirming somebody's suspicion that they're not getting any better, and in fact they are getting worse. And then they might say, well, okay, $1 million question, how long have I got to live, doc? And that's a very difficult question to answer. And obviously, if you could tell somebody, then they could work out whether they've got time to go and visit their grandchildren in Australia, or whether they just got, you know, one more mow of the lawn. In fact, the way we guess is by getting that person to just think about what rate do they already know they're changing at. So if they are not quite so well from 1 year to the next, then they've probably got a life expectancy that's still in years. If, in fact, they're noticing that really they're noticeably weaker and less well from 1 week to the next, then you're probably counting in weeks into months, which is what Steve Hewlett's doctor had said to him. And so people then cut their cloth according to what's before them. So he did the really important things. He told his family that he loved them, and he married his girlfriend the same day. So people are amazingly resilient. Yes, it's very sad. Yes, it's not fair. Yes, you wish it wasn't now. So there is sadness, there are tears, there is crossness and frustration and rage, moments of despair. But they're all glued together by this really interesting hope that even if it's only a little while, it can be good, that I can say the important things, that the people who matter to me will be there for me when I need them the most.
Is there a possibility in that sort of care where you can think about the clinical side, but there's also a psychological side, a sort of a reconciling oneself to what's happening physically? Do you have to marry those two approaches, or do you just focus on the clinical?
So if you talk to a palliative care person, they will talk to you about holistic practice. In fact, most people in medicine and nursing will talk to you about holistic practice. But in palliative care, what we're trying to do is think about what it is that brings the person to us in the first place, which is usually a physical symptom, but sometimes it's an emotional symptom. Sometimes it's distress, sadness, anger, fear, panic. So physical symptoms and emotional needs and keeping them in harmony is really important, but so is who this person views themselves as. And we would call that a spiritual dimension. Might not be a religious dimension to them, but who am I and what am I worth and what has my life been about? Those kind of existential questions. That's the spiritual part of our person. And then we all live in a social context. We have friends, we have families, we have responsibilities that we may need to sort out, or we may fear that we're abdicating. So holistic care is about physical, emotional, spiritual and social domains, so that you're looking at a whole person.
Now, I'm going to ask you something a bit from left field here, and I'm not going to claim this is fact, but you know, I get this notion that there's a rise in demand for post-mortems. Is that true?
Oh, I don't know. That's an interesting question. I have to say I'm a bit of a fan of the post-mortem.
Oh.
Right. I have to declare an interest here, which is that I am married to a doctor who is a pathologist. And what I have observed from post-mortems is that they tell us things that we hadn't suspected. So in my palliative care practice, if I haven't been able to solve a symptom to the satisfaction of the patient and family, or even if they felt actually things were quite a lot better but I wasn't properly satisfied, I have asked families for permission for a post-mortem, and almost always they have said yes.
Is there never a fear that that might reflect on the care and whether mistakes were made?
Well, if we've made mistakes, we need to find out, don't we, so that we don't make the same mistake again. If you're genuinely interested in making a difference to every patient who comes in your care, then one of the ways that patients and families can help you in that endeavour is to help you find the information that will help the next patient. And so our local hospital would do those postmortems for us if patients died in the hospice. Obviously, if the patients died in the hospital, that wasn't an issue. And I would always make an appointment with the family afterwards to describe to them. I would attend the postmortem, and then I would describe to the family what it was that we found out. And we always find out just something very fascinating, maybe not to do with the care at all, but maybe just, you know, that the person had a very interesting heart with a valve that was a different shape from most people's heart valves, or, you know, they had an extra little lobe in their liver or something like that. But very often what we've been able to do is find out why that one niggling pain that they always had was a problem. Or I had a lady who had platinum coils in one of her arteries to hold the arteries open, and she'd been put on drugs to stop the blood from clotting on those coils. So lots of people take anticoagulants for a variety of reasons. She was taking anticoagulants for that reason. But obviously, if those coils let the artery close up, it was the artery to her lungs, so that was pretty serious. But I wanted to give her a particular type of painkiller that can sometimes cause the stomach lining to bleed as a side effect, and you mustn't give that drug to people on anticoagulant drugs. So we had a difficult choice to make. She had horrible pain, and I couldn't give her the painkiller that she needed because she was on anticoagulants. So she decided she would take the risk. She stopped her anticoagulants. She took the painkillers. She had 3 very good weeks of pain-free, able to move around living before she died of the illness we were expecting her to die from. And her sister gave permission for a post-mortem on her body. And so we were able to photograph the absolutely squeaky, clean platinum coils with no clot at all on them, which has meant that other patients in the future have not had to worry about that choice between anticoagulants or pain control. So that lady's post-mortem really helped us help other people.
Do you know, that's absolutely fascinating. Now, do you know, I'm so fascinated by what you've got to say, and there's so much we could talk about, but I'm going to finish with one quick question. And it was really for those that might have heard the word palliative care, the phrase palliative care, for the first time, and they're reconciling themselves to going through this process. What would you say to those people at the start of a palliative care journey?
I think that's a really interesting question. I think that what you're going to discover when you meet a palliative care specialist is somebody who's really, really interested in who you are and how you want to be at this really challenging time in your life. And they will help you to set the goals that you want to set that are sensible and achievable for you, and then they will work with you to help you to achieve them.
Marvellous. Well put. I hope I can look at that in the face when my time comes. Dr. Catherine Mannix, thank you ever so much. As I say, we could have gone over more and more ground. Will you come back and talk to us again?
I think I might, for another cup of coffee.
Oh, go on, we can manage that. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
Well, after that, I'd think I'd say thank you, Catherine.
Yeah,
what a fascinating insight into palliative care and how it works.
You wouldn't say no to having her by your bedside, would you?
You definitely wouldn't. What a soothing voice she has.
Knows her stuff too.
Absolutely.
Well, you know what, Steph?
Tell me, James.
It's time. I know this is your favourite bit. It's time for this.
Death chatter. It's just a chat about death.
I'll never tire of that, Steph, that little intro that you do for death chatter.
You're welcome,
It entertains
James.
me. Right, serious note then.
Yes.
Now, it's funny because I think today's death chatter is really appropriate because, as you remember, we spoke to Sue McDermott, didn't we?
We did.
Last month. Sue McDermott from the Rainbow's UK Child Bereavement Charity. And it seems to be in the news at the moment. There's all sorts of talk about children or reflecting back when they were children, really struggling either with the death of a parent or a loved one. And I guess that the profile stuff we've seen in the media has been footballer, the England international footballer Rio Ferdinand, now retired, who really sadly lost his wife in 2015 after she died fighting breast cancer, only 34 actually, his wife. And he was part of a documentary, Being Mum and Dad, really appropriately titled, that I found absolutely fascinating. And obviously the difficulty in bringing up three young children, you know, without their mum and having to cope with the very real concerns there.
I know, it's just unimaginable in one sense, and yet, you know, you keep on going, you know, you have to deal with it. But I think it is really, really fascinating, actually, the fact that he realised how important it was to talk about this kind of stuff, especially with children. I'm not a parent, but I can imagine that parents watching that would have felt actually a sense of learning from him, you know, thinking, what if it ever happened to me? How would I cope? You know, and I think the fact that he was brave, it takes bravery to go and talk so openly about something which clearly is affecting him so deeply and continues to affect him and his three children.
I'll tell you what, Steph, this is a good time actually to play this short clip from the documentary Being Mum and Dad. Very, very poignant and pretty much says it all in 30 seconds. Listen to this.
This is one of the only things in life that we're going to go through together where I haven't got the answers from. And that's quite a worrying, daunting thing. When they don't speak, it's kind of difficult sometimes. You're just sitting there going like, what are they thinking? Where are they? Are they worried? Are they happy? Are they sad? I'm desperate to know, but I don't want to scare them. I want the best case end scenario for my kids. And so the only way I see that happening is for me to ask questions. I need help. I do need help, I know that.
I should say that the clip you've just heard comes from the excellent BBC documentary Rio Ferdinand, Being Mum and Dad. It was originally screened on BBC One, but if you can't get it on iPlayer, you can certainly buy it from the BBC store. It's an important thing that he's done, actually, in doing that, because I think people tend to maybe think of celebrities as a bit untouchable or having perfect lives, you know, nothing bad ever happens, they're happy all the time. And I think for someone with as high a profile as him to come forward and say, actually, we're all human and this is the most human thing that can happen to someone and to a group of people, and you know, here's my experience. And I think that it says a lot for raising the profile of talking about death generally in our society. You know, even a few years ago, 20 years ago, people didn't talk about death in the same way. Another example of people who are high profile people who are talking about grief at the moment are, of course, Prince William and Prince Harry, talking about the death of their mother, which was 20 years ago this year, and only now are they able to speak so publicly about it. And actually, at the time of Princess Diana's death and her funeral, some of the newspapers actually lauded the boys for being so restrained in their emotions and for not showing publicly their emotions. And how the tables have turned. Today we are absolutely praising them to the rooftops, as well as Rio Ferdinand, for being so open about saying, actually, it's okay to talk about it and to feel that way, and especially as children, but also obviously in adulthood as well. You know, just because you're an adult doesn't mean you know how everything works and doesn't mean you can be strong all the time.
And you know, that great thing with the Rio Ferdinand piece is that it was obvious that, you know, it wasn't the traditional footballer with the wag. You know, I think Rebecca Ellison trained as an accountant. It seems they were quite private, actually. I mean, obviously, their lives were under scrutiny, as you would be if you're that high profile. But, you know, they clearly valued their privacy, valued family life. And you know, I have five children, so I do look at those little ones. And I think I can understand how he's totally bereft and, you know, apparently even obviously contemplating suicide. So it doesn't matter what you've got in material terms.
Yeah.
There are some things that are incredibly hard to deal with.
Absolutely.
That money can't replace, frankly.
Yes. And I think that, you know, you touch on him that he said he thought about committing suicide. And you think, actually, grief can affect us in all sorts of ways. So much of it is tied in with our own well-being, our own mental well-being as well, which is obviously a cause which princes are also championing at the moment, is mental health. And I think that it's the two actually come hand in hand. And as a society, we are far better than we were even 10 years ago at talking about mental health. And I think the hope that Rio Ferdinand has with his documentary is that we will, you know, raise talking about death to equal levels of importance.
Absolutely. And I think actually, you know, the royals cop some flack, footballers cop some flack, but let's give a bit of credit on this occasion, because they were very brave, I think, doing that. Right, Steph, that's Death Chatter for this month. And it's that time of the show where we get a little bit spiritual with this.
The View from the Chaplain's Chair.
Right, well, this is the section of our podcast that we're calling The View from the Chaplain's Chair. And we're joined today by Father George Bowen, who, I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, Father, you were chaplain at the Royal Marsden for some years.
I was, indeed. Chaplain at the Royal Marsden, and before then at the Royal Brompton. So I've had experience in two hospitals, yeah.
Well, let's tap into that experience. I'm going to dive straight in here. Yeah. Now, often it's very, very difficult to have conversations with people dying or approaching death. How on earth do you manage to do that?
Well, the first thing is, I think that when people that are terminally ill see a priest approach them, it's them that start the conversation often, or don't want to start the conversation, or go away kind of thing. We don't need you yet. You sometimes get that comment coming back. But at the end of the day, the role of the chaplain, more than anything else, is to allow a conversation to begin. It's allowing the person that's suffering to actually open up and talk about stuff which has been burning inside of them in one way or another, and which has been dragging. I don't know whether burning is the right expression, but it's caused them a great deal of distress. It's unspoken stuff. So the chaplain gives the patient the chance to start speaking. And I think that's the most important role that I have, really, or that I had, was to open those conversations up so that they would be able to start unloading.
Did you ever get people that weren't Christian, weren't Catholic, that still wanted to talk to you as a chaplain?
Yes, sometimes you would, absolutely. Of course, inevitably, in this day and age, you know, you're focusing on the people that you know either want to see a chaplain, or that you know a Catholic in the hospital. As a Catholic chaplain, you're given the list of those that are Catholic, or were, at any rate, given the list of those that are Catholic, and that you were able to go in and put yourself about a bit and say hello to them, and allow them to make those, to open those conversations. But often, people would stop you on the way at another bed, you know, and say, "Hey, can I have a word?" And you'd open up in one way or another.
How much of it is, how can I put this? I'd imagine people aren't sort of, or some must be direct, and I need a chaplain, and Father, come here. For others, do you have to work your way towards how they're actually feeling before you get to the crux of what they want to say?
Yes, I think you can always open the conversation by, "How are you feeling? How's today been?" And, you know, starting always with the present, at the present moment. Where are they at the moment? And you're just opening up, letting people, asking open questions, which allow people to start stepping in and take the conversation where they want it to go. You give them permission to go to places where they wouldn't necessarily have gone before in the conversation that they've had. And I think the most important thing is that you don't just simply leave them there, but that you give them the opportunity and the confidence to be able to have that conversation. You leave them with the fact that they could have that conversation with other members of the family, with their loved ones. And so often, the question that you first asked about, you know, addressing a patient that's got difficulties, assumes that the patient is on his or her own, but they may not be. And it may be that you come to them another time when their family are there, and that's often very valuable. And then you can start talking to them in front of their family about subjects, and it suddenly gives everybody permission to think and talk about dying. I think that's one thing. And the other thing I think is important is that, in a sense, the person that ought to lead all conversations is the person that's in the bed, so to speak, the one that's dying. And they need to, in one way or another, take ownership of their journey.
Bizarre question, or maybe not, but did you enjoy being a chaplain?
Oh, the word I would have said is the privilege. It is genuinely an incredible privilege because you learn so much about yourself and you learn so much about human nature. And you see more than anything, I find it an enormously rewarding thing, especially in the Royal Marsden, where I was dealing with a lot of people that really were at end stages. And you see about how people can grow. As their bodies seem to diminish, they grow. And you can be involved in that and sharing in that. And standing back in great admiration at the way that they seem to be given strengths, which they didn't even realise that they had, and everybody else, and that's a great, great privilege.
Father George Bowen, thank you very much. That's the view from the chaplain's chair for April.
Well, James, I think it's sadly time to say goodbye. It's the
are
end.
You sad?
I am sad.
No, I'm glad you are. otherwise, I'll get offended.
Yes. Well, this is the end of April's podcast from The Art of Dying Well, but never fear, we'll be back in May with lots more to tell you.
Absolutely. A subject as yet undecided, absolutely, if we're going to be totally honest with our listeners. But as we're wrapping up this podcast, we shouldn't let you go without giving you a few ways of actually getting in touch with us, getting in touch with the show. On Twitter, at Art of Dying Well. Instagram, likewise, Art of Dying Well, and Facebook, Art of Dying Well. Our website, of course, artofdyingwell.org, which has plenty of resources, visual resources, all sorts of stuff to download, and really does aim to be that hopeful accompaniment for the journey. If you want to use email to contact us, good old-fashioned email, please do, theartofdyingwell@gmail.com. It's been a pleasure having your company. Thank you very much indeed. Do stick with us. Early days for the Art of Dying Well podcast. But we'll look forward to talking to you again next month.
We certainly will.